Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast, Season 4, Episode 11. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario. I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we also have Jonathan Kuhlein on the line in Mississauga, Ontario.
What up, my boys?
See, I thought I'd mix it up there, you know? What up? The sky is up. That's what my old vice principal teacher used to say.
I bet he was a lot of fun.
He was. Rest in peace. He was a lot of fun. Anywho, so I have some fact check for you folks. First of all, Annie Wershing was in Enterprise Season 1, Episode 20 as Liana. And I watched that episode the other day. I fired it up on Crave to watch it because I had no recollection of it. And it's funny because I saw a headline today, but I didn't watch it. What's the name of the guy who plays Jonathan Archer?
Oh, Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula was saying, he was explaining how 9/11 changed the tone of Enterprise. And I remember I complained about that at the time, all of a sudden it became a war trek, right? Anyway, because it was much more science-y and that kind of stuff in the first one. Anyway, so this was part of the science-y sort of stuff. And Rene, I don't know how to say his last name. Rene Aubergeois? How do you say his name?
Aubergeois.
Okay. So he Odo, as, also known as, he was the mad scientist in this one. He plays Ezral. The plot of this episode was based on The Tempest by William Shakespeare, but it's also the same plot as in Forbidden Planet, The Cage, you know, the first pilot for Star Trek, the original series, and also Requiem for Methuselah in the original series, Season 3, Episode 19. And according to Rene, unpronounceable, it was also the plot of Shadow Play on DS9, Season 2, Episode 16. So it's basically, you know, the story is that, you know, this Tucker meets this really, you know, attractive girl and sort of, you know, falls madly in love with her, kind of doesn't really fall madly in love with her, but has affections for her. They find the shipwrecked planet that's been, you know, shipwrecked for like 3 years or something like that. There's a whole bunch of people on it. And this man and his daughter, turns out that all the people on it are holograms because they can't find any life signs, right? They're all holograms. And the engineer, who is played by Rene, he's invented these people to entertain and educate his daughter based on people that were on the ship, right? Same sort of plot as before. So it's in Requiem for Methuselah, I think that was the one where they implied he was Leonardo da Vinci in the future kind of thing. Like, he never dies. He just keeps inventing stuff over and over again. And he made this robot girl that, you know, who thinks that she's alive and whatever. I may have that plot wrong. It may be a whole nother fact check coming in, folks. Buckle up. But yeah, just generally this sort of, I mean, obviously done first by Shakespeare, you know, this sort of, you know, mad scientist and his daughter kind of story, you know, and this sort of, and the thing is, like, they weren't shipwrecked on they weren't attacked or destroyed or whatever. They were actually, the engineer guy made a mistake and ended up killing all of his friends, and so he you know, basically rebuilds them as holograms. That's the plot of the story. But anywho, but coming back to Annie Wershing, who also is going to be playing the Borg Queen on Picard, which is why I'm going here. She also played on an FBI agent, Renee Walker, on 24. I don't know if either of you two guys watched 24.
Not ever.
I did not.
Not ever. No. Yeah. I watched a few episodes, but yeah. So much for that. So that's her. I mentioned last week, I was talking about The Walking Dead, and I mentioned Norman Reedus and all the people who are, you know, who are fans of The Walking Dead no longer listen to Spotcast, because I should have known, I should have been able to say that that was Daryl, or Daryl, you know.
Yeah.
So Norman Reedus.
Wait, your other brother Daryl?
Yeah, his other brother Daryl. That's yeah. Right. Yeah. And Juno Temple plays Keeley Jones on Ted Lasso. Yeah. And interestingly enough, I watched a bit of some of the IMDb stuff that Hannah Waddingham, as Rebecca Walton, she plays the owner of the football team. A question for you guys, do you know what other notable role she played?
I know her a little bit from, I put a little response in there, but yeah, she was in Wicked, and she's also currently on Sex Education on Netflix.
Oh, is she? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Anything else?
She was the...
I'll give you a one word hint. Repent.
Oh, she was the, the
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones woman, right? Yeah.
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 Unrecognizable as her, really, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I had to like do a double take. Are you sure? I should probably go back and watch just to be sure. She was also played a role in the 12 Monkeys TV show, but I don't think either of you guys watched that show, so that wouldn't have meant anything
mm-hmm.
to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know her sort of big claim to fame. She's a very famous stage actress in the West End and in London.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. All right, well, let's move on to the headlines. And John, you're up first, I guess.
Well, I couldn't resist this one. So our friends over at TrekMovie.com, who are probably even bigger Star Trek fans than we are, had an interview with Mike McMahon, the showrunner for Lower Decks. And they were talking about some of the quote-unquote backlash that came and controversy that came out of the Mugato Gomato... tomato episode of Lower Decks earlier this season, where, if you guys recall, there was a rather risque for Star Trek scene where two of the Mugato decide that they're going to get it on, as it were, and one of them sits back, a third one sits back and watches and starts playing with his horn, his sort of unicorn-esque horn on the top
on,
of these,
horn on his head.
On his head, on his, yes. Thank you very much for the correction.
For those of you listening at home.
Appreciate that, yep. Anyways, so they did an interview with Mike, and he, you know, they sort of said, well, you know, you had a little controversy about this racy content, you know, how are you feeling about this? And he said, you know, the other two shows that I work on are Solar Opposites and Rick and Morty. So, you know, there are much more strict limits on Lower Decks. And, you know, it was a good response. He basically said, I think Star Trek has always embraced sexuality, humanism, and all sorts of great stuff. When you're making shows like this, you're trying to find those limits. But even in TNG, you've got people tugging on Ferengi ears. There's always been that kind of stuff. And I think the moment that everybody has been all whipped up about has a Mugato yanking on its horn, which comedically is funny. It was one of those moments where artists kind of pushed for it, and they made me laugh. At the end of the day, we're trying to make a show that's Star Trek, but also makes you laugh. And I've got to be honest, for people that are pearl clutching and freaking out because we had a suggestive moment in an adult animated show, it's just falling on deaf ears. I think he's got a good point. I didn't realize at the time that there was, I guess, a little bit of, you know, people, you know, as he says, pearl clutching about, oh my goodness, this is very explicit for a Star Trek show. His point is, it is a cartoon, but it is a cartoon aimed at adults. It is meant to be boundary pushing it occasionally, especially for Star Trek. And I think probably both of you would agree that, you know, as far as Star Trek goes, this has pushed the limits pretty far. Star Trek doesn't. One of the things we sort of criticized it for in the past is that it takes itself a little too seriously. And this is the first time that it's in on its own joke. And I thought this was kind of an interesting controversy. Did you guys, I don't know, I mean, obviously you guys are, you know, not easily offended, but did you guys see any of that backlash or have anything in the moment that sort of occurred to you?
I don't think I even noticed, to be honest with you. Probably, we watch this show with such haste that sometimes I guess we don't really notice all. I mean, I know you do, but you notice a lot of stuff that we don't notice. But
yeah,
I missed that whole piece. I mean, you know, and I haven't seen anything online about it at all. So
I think interesting. It's one of those things that if you're old enough to know what's going on, you're probably like to get the joke, you're old enough to sort of know what's going on, right? Like, it's not like a very adult kind of thing, right? Like it, on the surface level, which is, it kind of just looks funny, right? And if your kid like went into school and was like doing this on the top of their head, it'd be like, what are these kids doing? It wouldn't immediately strike anyone as like, oh no, this is a sexual problem, right? Mm-hmm, So I think it works pretty well from that perspective. And so it's kind of like one of those jokes that I vaguely recall from, it was a DreamWorks movie. I think it was Robots with Ewan McGregor as the voice of the main character, where the lady robots they encounter, like a older lady, they say, oh, she has junk in her trunk, and she does have a, if she was a human, big bottom, but it literally is a trunk with junk inside of it, right? Like, so it was one of those, like, the kids can laugh, they're still relatively innocent, but if they kind of get it and they understand the adult spin on that, the innuendo, it's like you're kind of old enough to receive this content, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing about this is, like I mentioned before, if you watch it on Crave, or I'm sure on, what do you watch it on? Paramount Plus? They don't bleep out. There's certain words they do bleep out all the time, but like, you know, the F-bomb they always bleep, but the S's and stuff like that, they let those go. But if you watch it on Space, or not Space TV, CTV Sci-Fi Channel, they bleep out every potential swear word, you know? So, like, I've noticed a difference. Like, I watched an episode on Crave, and then I watched an episode, same episode on Space, or, sorry, CTV, I'm going to call it Space Channel, but on that channel, which they renamed, you know, The New Hope, it's the same show, and you get the same thing, and I've noticed the same thing. If I watch Rick and Morty on iTunes, there's no bleeping. Right. And yet, when you watch it on Adult Swim, there's tons of bleeping because there's tons of, you know, profanity. Right. And, you know, it's funny because it's funny about the whole thing about bleeping is it doesn't lose its impact with me. Right. Like when somebody goes into a sentence and you know what they're going to say. And it's like, you know, what was you were saying the other day about the Mel Brooks kind of way of, you know, oh, look at those huge, there's a jug of water over there, you know, kind of deal. I can't do it like you did, Jaime, but you know, when you bleep the word, you know the adults in the room can fill it in, the kids just hear a bleep, right? You know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know, I think, you know, like we've said before, they tend, people take Star Trek far too seriously. I think that's the problem, right? And that's what's great about this and Lego Star Wars is that, you know, it doesn't take it seriously, right?
Yeah.
Too seriously.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay.
I'll throw a link in the show notes. I found the Calvin and Hobbes comic that seemed pretty timely. The basic gist of it is the boy Calvin and his possibly imaginary pet tiger Hobbes are looking at the TV listings. And he says, hey, this movie has, quote, adult situations. What are adult situations? And the punchline is Hobbes saying probably things like going to work, paying bills and taxes, taking responsibilities, which is probably the way to look at it. You know, those are truly, no euphemism in mind, those are adult situations.
Yeah, for sure.
That pretty much nails it.
Yep.
So next up, we have the Emmy Awards were this week, the Primetime Emmy Awards. And we had gone in, I don't think any of us really had the highest hopes that we were going to see one of our sort of sci-fi fantasy genre things walk out on top, even though we've had a precedent with things like Game of Thrones. You know, Mandalorian was up for best drama, you know, WandaVision had some nominations. We definitely had some good stuff mixed in there, but I got to be honest, I didn't really go in with very high hopes. And even ones where you sort of thought, wow, what an amazing performance, like Elizabeth Olsen for WandaVision. You know, she was up for best performance in a limited series by an actress against Kate freaking Winslet. So good luck to that.
Hello. Yeah.
So as good as we thought she was, she was facing an uphill climb. Anyways, bottom line on this is the Emmys have come and gone, and there were zero wins for genre shows in the major categories. There was lots of wins. The Mandalorian walked away with, I believe, 14 Emmys. But yeah, they were all in the creative arts. Stunt coordination. They were for special effects, visual effects, for makeup, for all the more sort of creative side, cinematography, and again, all well deserved. It was a really excellent show. But yeah, as far as the main categories, best drama, best actor, best actress, any of that stuff, all those shows got absolutely bupkis. So I think it's good. I think we got a little progress that those shows were acknowledged. And obviously it's a big win for Disney Plus to get that kind of recognition. But in the end, Full of Sound and Fury signifying
nothing.
And speaking of Hannah Waddingham, she won for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy for Ted Lasso. So good for her. There, and then go. Brett Goldstein won for Best Supporting Actor and Best.
What wasn't he? Wasn't he win for CGI?
That's right.
Best CGI character.
In a
FIFA character.
That's right. And Jason Sudeikis won, and the show won for Best Comedy. So yeah, well done for them.
Is that what the story is, Jaime? That people think he's a FIFA character, yeah, like from. Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I haven't seen the second season, but I've seen a screenshot, a still from the second season, and there's just something kind of eerie about how he looks like a CGI character from your, FIFA, 2021 video game, where they do the little cinematic in the locker room, at halftime to get you immersed, like as if it's a real broadcast. And I can sort of see there's just something a little off. I don't know if it's about him. I don't know if it's makeup. I don't know if it's cinematography, but it's something.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, and the Emmys between The Crown, Ted Lasso, and I just realized Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, the real key to winning the Emmys is to include the British in accent, some way. Yeah. Yeah. And there's your key to victory.
Yeah. Well, and the funny part of that is that Kate Winslet did win for Best Performance in a Miniseries, was doing an American accent as a Brit, which is very funny.
Yeah. Wow.
So apparently you have to do an accent. It doesn't matter which one.
Interesting.
And apparently, Mandalorian accents don't count.
Yeah.
We've got the first trailer here for the yet another Tom Hanks movie on Apple TV Plus. This time, though, he is playing a character in a post-apocalyptic world. So this is Finch. Starts off with a doggo friend and then builds himself a robo friend. Seems like it could be pretty interesting. I'm definitely keen for Tom Hanks films in general.
Did you watch the other one that's on Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus?
What's it called?
Greyhound. Yeah,
it
was good.
Is it good?
It's good. It's tense.
Yeah.
It's definitely into the World War II submarine drama kind of thing.
Yeah, dramedy, yes, exactly. Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting movie. I mean, it's not Hunt for Red October, but it's still good.
Yeah, Bridge of Spies is one that came out a few years back, which, as far as Steven Spielberg movies go, it was lower on the tier than I think some people were hoping for. But I thought that was a tremendous movie about the Cold War, and Tom Hanks was really good.
Yeah, I should watch that one.
It was good. I really liked it.
The one I haven't seen, too, is the one where he's on the road or something like that. He's a hitman or something with his son.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
I never quite made it through that one. He's sort of like a, he's a sort of a Deckard type character, I guess. Alrighty. Yeah, looking forward to that one. I just saw a trailer for it and it had a robot in it. And I'm like, okay, I'm all over it. I'll watch that.
Yeah. It kind of rounds out things because you had, Greyhound, which was the World War II one. This is not an Apple TV Plus, I don't think, but he had News of the World, where he was in the Wild West, so now he goes into the future.
Cool.
Next, I have, we're going to lead off with Shang-Chi coming free, he says in air quotes, to all Disney Plus subscribers on November 12th. But that's just only one thing, because this is part of Disney Day, which, besides Shang-Chi, which is, don't get me wrong, that's a huge thing, want to talk more about that. We're also going to get free access to Jungle Cruise, which is currently on premium access. a Boba Fett origin special, Home Sweet Home Alone, which I don't know if that's a reboot or a continuation of the Home Alone cinematic universe, and then new shorts linked to Frozen, Luca, and The Simpsons. So just like a shock ton of content coming out that day.
Yeah, and they're doing it as another one of those event days, right? It's like Disney Plus Day or something. Because they're doing a whole like reveal part of this too. There's more content that's going to be announced.
Yeah, yeah. So this is interesting because unlike Black Widow, which was a simultaneous release in theaters and Disney Plus or premium access, Shang-Chi has kind of a more traditional, but kind of not. I mean, it's a super accelerated traditional of like in theaters exclusively. After that exclusive period is up, moving to Disney Plus, but not as a premium thing. So it seems like they're drawing the line there of like, nope, this is, you know, like as if you waited long enough to see it for free on your streaming channel, which is interesting there.
So did Scarlett Johansson's lawyers punish Disney enough that they pulled all the sort of leasing to home kind of content? Because it's kind of sort of what we said last week, right? Do we know? Or is it still being settled? Or
I think that case is still being settled, but I kind of wonder if they buttoned up contracts and stuff for the later release stuff, given what had happened with that one.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, Jaime, because actually there was a story in the Hollywood Reporter a couple of days ago. So because of that suit, apparently Bob Chapek, the Disney CEO, Chapek, said that the standard talent deals for talent are going to be reset, and future agreements will take into account changes to release windows accelerated by the pandemic. So that is sort of out there that this is happening, that they are in light of this changing, but they still haven't settled on how that's going to play out as far as her demands for, I believe it was $100 million.
Yeah. And, you know, there were folks like me who decided to show their support by buying tickets. In my case, I, for safety reasons, didn't want to go, so I bought a ticket for a showing that was like already on to throw some money. Clearly, they didn't need that because Shang-Chi was a huge success in theaters, so no problem there. People are showing their support. We, I guess, fortunately, because we're not going to be spending any more money on Disney, Disney Plus premium access, we don't have a way to show support, you know, with our dollars for Shang-Chi. But I would say, you know, watch the movie again if you already saw it on Disney Plus. If you are not interested in seeing it, but are interested in that kind of content existing, go ahead and put it in the background and turn it on. And that still counts as a stream as far as Disney's concerned, right? They don't really have a clue if you're actually watching it or not. So do your bit to see this sort of, inclusivity thing continue to happen.
Okay.
So that being said, I wanted to look this up because I know we talked about it last week and we were sort of very happy that it had debuted well and things were performing well. But I was just looking up where the numbers are at now. So apparently it has grossed $176.8 million domestic. So that's Canada and the United States. Global gross is now at $288.8 million. So $288.8 million US dollars, which sounds decent, but I'm just reading an article from themix.net where they're pointing out that if you compare that across the cinematic universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that is the third worst grossing MCU movie of all time. The only two movies that it's ahead of are Incredible Hulk and Captain America the First Avenger, which came back in 2008 and 2011 respectively. And that was sort of before the MCU really got its legs. Those were first wave movies. And if you factor in inflation, they point out Shang-Chi currently tops only The Incredible Hulk. Because if adjusted for inflation, Captain America First Avenger actually made more. So it's kind of mixed messages there. Because again, you do have to take into account the circumstances. But still, that's not good.
It's kind of a weird one. When they took that into account, did they remove Black Widow's streaming results? They went purely on box office for Black Widow?
I don't know. I'm looking at it. It actually does mention Black Widow in here, and it says that Black Widow is still in theaters, but brought in a mere $180,000 this past weekend. But it doesn't say. Oh, maybe there's a chart here. Hang on. Weekend comparison, week comparison, overall comparison. Oh, I love this. These guys have really broken things down here.
Great podcast.
I know, isn't this great? Yeah, you can feel free to edit this. We can edit
this. Yeah, trust me, this will all go in the can.
I'm curious about this because it's in a weird spot, right? It was like for the historians, you know, the alien species that unearth the digital archives and are listening to this to figure out what humanity was doing at this time in 2021. In this particular time, it's not a great time. Things are getting, you know, somewhat better. That's true. We've got vaccinations and stuff, but those have stalled. There's talk of booster shots and stuff. I just don't see, like, if you're going to go into the theaters, I think you go once to see a movie. You don't go multiple times, regardless of how you felt about the film, because it's just not worth the risk, right? You might have calculated the risk that, like, all right, I'm going to go and see it, you know, once. Are you going to go 10 times like you would for some other movie? Maybe not, right? Because, like, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. So I kind of wonder how sort of fair it is to not take that into account when we're analyzing that. Right? I mean, the fact that it did pretty well for, you know, what appears to be first viewing stuff is pretty good. Now, repeat viewings, and does it have legs for that? Kind of hard to untangle that from the pandemic. You kind of want to see what things like Venom do, right? That might give us a good barometer.
That's it. I mean, we know this fall we're going to get Venom. We're going to get James Bond. We know that there's some decent stuff. Dune is still on the slate. So, and of course, The Matrix. So we'll see whether this is, you know, I think you're right, Jaime. I think this is probably a more apt comparison to those performances, not to previous Marvel movies. But it is going to be interesting to see where Marvel's appetite for these, with due respect, smaller Marvel movies are, given the circumstances of displaying movies now.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be interesting to see if those have a similar pattern of people feel good enough to go out, watch one time, but not enough to do repeat visits for movies. See if they have big opening weekends and then they sort of peter out after that.
Well, and especially for, you know, debuting a character, like the next Marvel movie is going to be The Eternals. That's another one where you're like, well, there's no built-in audience for that other than for an MCU writ large. But Spider-Man's going to do gangbusters, and Doctor Strange is going to do gangbusters, because those are established characters and people like them and they've already gone on adventures, and so people are bought in already. I think that was one of the challenges for Shang-Chi, and it was also one of the challenges for The Eternal, will be one of the challenges for The Eternal, is how do they motivate you to go to the theater other than just the branding of MCU makes good movies, right?
Hard to say.
All right, last news thing for the week. We have a name and we have a release date for the third Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them spinoff from the Harry Potterverse movie. Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore is scheduled to hit theaters on April 15th, 2022. It was initially supposed to come out on July 15th. So it's been moved up a few months. And yeah, apparently we'll be focusing on The Secrets of Dumbledore.
Ooh.
Yeah. And no Johnny Depp, which is interesting because that's he obviously was removed or... Yes, removed from the project due to some...
What character does he play?
He was playing Gellert Grindelwald, the villain.
Yeah.
He sort of pops up at the very end of the first one, and then he is the sort of central villain in the second one.
Mikkelsen will take over the role.
But Mads Mikkelsen is gonna take over. Mads Mikkelsen, of course, from James Bond and Hannibal. Yeah. So, interesting. I always feel conflicted when they recast actors partway through a series. In some cases, obviously, it works out. You know, I think Don Cheadle has been a very good War Machine, and Rhodey in the Iron Man / Avengers movies, taking over for Terrence Howard. but it always seems a little incongruous sometimes, especially when you do a rewatch, you're like, oh, that's right. I forgot that that other person played that role.
Well, that used to happen all the time in 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Are we going to talk about Bewitched again?
No. Oh. Did we talk about that?
Dick York?
The regeneration?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that was an odd one. But yeah, no, and well, and the woman who plays Ginger on all the Gilligan's Island remakes, right?
Yeah, that's right. They did end
Tina up... Tina Louise getting... played the first one, and then the rest are...
Yeah, somebody else in a big Tina Louise wig, right?
Yeah, but I mean, that kind of stuff happened all the time, right? So
Yeah. It just becomes more glaring when they're doing these big, like, I think...
Well, Blofeld was always a different dude in James Bond too,
it's
right?
It's true. Although in nowadays, especially, I think, you know, you get used to them locking in these actors saying, okay, we're going to do a 6-film trilogy and then, you know, all these spin-off parts. So you're going to play a main character in these trilogies and then, you know, you're going to dip into these other ones. And you sort of get used to these sort of recurring faces. It is unusual to have that circumstance. Although, again, I can't say I disagree with the rationale behind the... this particular case. So.
Well, yeah, but I thought Johnny Depp had a bad couple of years. Like, wasn't there like...
Yes, it was a domestic abuse accusation, yeah, which so was proven in court.
They wanted to distance himself from any question, you know?
Oh, I think from a Warner Brothers perspective, this is, you know, the movies weren't terribly well received, especially the second one wasn't terribly well received to begin with. And they were going to have to do a little bit of rehab to try and make people care. There's no, I think, coincidence as to why this is called The Secrets of Dumbledore, because they want people to be like, oh, Dumbledore, I know who Dumbledore is, you know.
But is Jude Law playing him again? Or
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Then I'll watch.
There you go.
As long as they don't mess up the Dumbledore guy and play him by two different actors.
That's
one died.
That's one of my favorite memes. Is at what point did Dumbledore go from wearing, you know, elegant bespoke suits in the prequel movies to wearing the like garish robes with the fez in the Harry Potter movies? At what point did he just stop caring about his attire?
Yeah. Well, and then there's the two different portrayals by Richard Harris and the other guy, Gambon, Michael Gambon, who they famously named Gambon's Turn in the Top Gun test track.
Top Gear. I do think we can cut a little slack on that one with Mr. Harris having died and all, you know, it's not like they can do much about that one.
Yeah, they could have rewritten the whole book. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah,
not at the time. See, had it occurred a few years later, we could have had Christopher Plummer, right? And then if it had gone too far where he had passed away, you know, rest in peace, it could be Dick Notaro as Dumbledore, right?
And then Betty White to fill in when she's got tired. Right?
Then Betty White buries that whole cast too.
Wait, so what's the Dick Notaro context?
That was from the Netflix zombie. What was it? What was it called? Something of the Dead? Like Vegas of the Dead?
No, I know what you mean.
The Heist of the Dead?
The yeah, it was one the Zack guy, Snyder the one, wasn't it?
Remember the one zombie was living and
it's bugging me. I'm looking at Army of the Dead.
There it is.
The one where Chris Delia ran into some, let's say, legal troubles and then got CGI replaced after the fact by Dick Notaro.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, okay. Which is something I'd... suggested on the internets that they should have done in Jeopardy, which went through all this drama with its executive producer taking over the show. Bad things happen. They kick them off. Oh no, we already have a competitive show in the can. What do we do? I said they should just replace him with Dick Notaro and just not even talk about it again. Just pretend it didn't happen.
What have they done on Jeopardy? Like, is Mayim Bialik going to be a host, or is she going to be a part-time host?
She and Ken Jennings will take over for the rest of the season.
Oh, Ken Jennings. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
But they did they aired the ones with the deposed executive producer. Those were aired within the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So don't you think that's a little megalomaniacal to put yourself in that role?
I think that was yes, definitely an issue of contention for sure.
Great.
All righty. Well, guess what, kids? We're at that part of the show, learning time for kiddos, it says here. Oh, no, I said this later on. So we're at the part of the show where we talk about Lower Decks, or a Star Trek vehicle in this case. It's going to be Lower Decks, Season 2, Episode 7, Where Pleasant Fountains Lie. And I think Jaime is going to do the recap, so off you go.
Yeah, if we were that kind of show, we would have the like Masterpiece Theater music or something go on here, because this is learning time. So that title, Where Pleasant Fountains Lie, I looked it up because a lot of these things you just say, you know, the title of the episode, Shakespeare, and see what you get. And I found a good one. So this is a quote from Venus and Adonis by William Shakespeare. Let me just read this. It's a handful of lines. Fondling, she say, since I have hemmed thee here within the circuit of this ivory pale, I'll be a park, and thou shalt be my dear. Feed where thou wilt, on mountain or in dale, graze on my lips, and if those hills be dry, stray lower where the pleasant fountains lie.
My goodness.
Yeah, so saucy. Saucy from 500 to 600 years ago. This will be important contextually for this episode. Yeah, so we start right in the thick of things with the Cerritos crew finishing up saving a planet from an evil computer which had tricked the people into fighting a hundred year war, as they are wont to do. This is a common TOS trope for sure, right?
Oh yeah.
So this is Lord Agamas, I think is how they pronounced it.
Yep.
I think voiced, and I did not check, but it certainly sounded like Jeffrey Combs to me.
It was, yeah.
I did check, and it was, yeah.
Okay. So my ears were good. So Lord Agamas is being wheeled away by Commander Ransom, and he tries to flatter Ransom into connecting him into the computer and say, no, don't do that. That's just what he does. He's trying to trick you there, right? Oh, okay. Let's pack him up, take him away. Because he is a sentient being, so does have some rights. They're not just going to smash him to bits like something out of like Office Space. Right. we go back to the Cerritos, where I wrote Queen Paolana. I'm sure we can find the name, but basically the queen of the species we're about to meet today has called upon and requested aid from the Cerritos. And in particular, they need Chief Engineer Billups's abilities. And oh, by the way, he happens to be her son. Cut to the intro theme, right? So we've got the setup there. When we come back from the intro theme, the lower deckers are in their bunks talking about how phaser rifles are different or not from regular phasers.
What is the difference, Jaime?
Here they claim it's like, well, one's two-handed, the other's not, which is, I suppose, true. I guess, you know, battery packs differences, you know, you could probably last longer with a phaser rifle, but maybe it hypothetically can pump out more juice. Right, because it's a larger device, but practically speaking, it's not like you're getting a larger caliber, right? This isn't like a hand pistol versus, you know, a bazooka.
Yeah, in retrospect, if you think back to all the shows, you never see them firing like a wider beam or a different dispersal pattern. It's just the same exact effect. It's just on a longer handheld versus a longer device. You know, kind of disappointing.
Yeah, you would think the rifle would be the equivalent of, you remember the movie Predator, the original Predator, yeah, with Jesse the Body Ventura walking out with the minigun as he's tearing up the jungle with a hailfire of bullets. That's what you would think the phaser rifle would be. No, it kind of shoots like a regular phaser.
Even just a wide dispersal blast, like a shotgun or something, you know, you'd think there would be some benefit, but it's a perfect trope. I love how these guys dissect these things, right?
Yeah, they start asking the questions that we all want the answer to. They don't answer it here, but it is, you know, asked at least. Either way, Boimler is excited for a mission involving giant centipedes, just, you know, like he did back on the Titan, as he mentions his time away there. But he's disappointed because he gets reassigned to a cargo mission, right? That's terrible. Not fun. So come back later. We cut over to the Cerritos, rendezvousing with the alien species ship. Billups, the chief engineer, says, you know, don't fall for any of the queen's tricks. He had apparently given up the Ren Faire, or Renaissance Faire, if you prefer, life by abdicating the throne to join Starfleet. That only stays true as long as he is a virgin.
Yeah.
So a weird concept for the duty that he needs to take on. The queen arrives in engineering to talk about their, quote, dragon breath engines breaking down. We'll learn more about that. It sounded weird, but it fits in with the Ren Faire concept, right? Separately, Rutherford is nervous about the assignment because he's been tasked to join, you know, diagnosing what this problem is. But Tendi in particular pushes him to go outside of his comfort zone. They're like, yay, you can do it. Go get it done, right? We cut over to Mariner and Boimler. They're in their shuttle en route. And as happens in Starfleet, you hit a gravimetric shear and you crash land on a planet, right? And
but luckily you can breathe there.
Yes, luckily there's no like, oh, we got to hang on to the EV suits unless it's like specifically part of the plot, right? Yeah. And this planet does have a bunch of other crash ships, so they're, you know, not unique in this respect. Unfortunately, Mariner has a fractured arm and they're outside of comms range. They do have a replicator, but apparently it's made by the Dutch because it only provides black licorice, which the Dutch love, apparently. Side note, I do know this because I had a boss many years ago who was from the Netherlands, and he was chowing down on that stuff, and he explained to me that, like, the Dutch do enjoy themselves in black licorice.
Yeah, I have a friend who's Dutch, and same deal. Every year for Christmas, they get in it. Just disgusting, but they loved it.
Tastes like poison, as they say in the episode. Not wrong, not wrong. Another one who survived the wreckage is Lord Agamas, who is asking for help. And, oh, you know, you can connect me to the ship and I can help check things out. Again, he's trying to trick them into getting the connectivity that he wants. Back on the Renfair ship, Phillips and Rutherford arrive. And it is very Renfair with, you know, masterpiece portraits and people, you know, dressed like as if they're in a Renaissance fair.
And a lot of huzzas.
A lot of huzzas, and everything is renamed to sound like magic. So the Dragon Breath engines is like, oh, they talk about their warp engines, right? And their warp core, etc. And Billups and Rutherford are looking into the problem. He's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. This can't possibly be. And the Queen says, oh, is this problem beyond you? You know, hinting, you know, give up. You know, you're not good at this. You should come be king. He's like, no, I just need to run a full diagnostic from the bottom up. And he's got this background comment, passing comment from one of the guards is like, I'd like to run your full diagnostic from my bottom up.
Very, speaking again, of dirty lines in this show.
Very salacious, which is why I took the time to read out the lengthy Shakespeare quote, because that was your hint right there in the title, if you knew, right?
Yeah.
Back on the planet, Lorik Agamas scans Boimler and tries to scare him into complying. Oh, you're like not looking too good, and oh, I can help things out. Again, he's doing his thing. Meanwhile, a beast on the planet attacks the crew. They scramble and go hide in the shuttle while the beast is chowing down at the emergency rations, which is making life worse for them, right? They were already in a bad situation. In the
they still have the replicator, though, right? So they can make all the licorice
that's
they want.
Right. As long as they want licorice, they're fine.
Yeah, they're running out of water, but the black licorice is bountiful. And in the confusion, Lord Agamas has done a data transfer from one of the pads, you know, PADD pads, kind of like an old school iPad in there. And he's pulled down some data related to Boimler, and that will come into play later. You know, after they figure out that they're running out of water, they say, all right, well, we're going to have to go into the desert. If there's creatures here, there must be water of some sort for them to survive. Go find it. Boimler decides to put the computer in a bundle, kind of like a baby swaddle attached to you, like a papoosa.
Not a papoosa, a papoosa. Uniform. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Makeshift one. They do end up finding some edible fruits, and Boimler and Mariner fight about who should climb to get the fruits, because normally that's a Mariner thing, but she's... You know, she's injured, and Boimler's throwing out, oh, we did this thing like all the time. And like, I was rock climbing on the Titan, again, bringing up his time away. In the kerfuffle, you know, Boimler does a Boimler thing, falls off the tree. He's angry at Mariner and like rubbing his face. He kicks he doesn't kick the tree. He kicks like a rocket piece or some sort of debris that's connected to the tree, which actually shakes the tree and causes fruit to fall, you know, that they wanted. And they go and munch on it. They're like, oh my God, it still tastes like black licorice. What the heck? and they're getting a little tired of Lord Agamas. So they like bury him in the sand as Mariner had suggested earlier. But he very quickly ends up getting kidnapped by crabs, and they, you know, they save him. And Boimler gets shown a video of, you know, what had happened and why he had gotten reassigned from the cool assignment into this, you know, less cool assignment. And it turns out that Mariner had been telling Ransom that, like, oh yeah, just do me a solid. Like, he's not ready for this. You should not have him on that mission. You should have him on this other mission. So she, you know, she went behind his back and hurt his, you know, his career abilities there. And so, of course, understandably, Boimler's angry that Mariner thinks he's not up to the big stuff, right? He's like, what the heck, man? It's not helping. Mariner's like, look, you're not ready for it. You're getting, you know, you're falling for this computer's tricks and everything. And she walks away with Lord Agamas. And that's kind of where we leave them for a little bit. We switch over to Rutherford and Billups. They find the problem with the engines. Huzzah, they've solved the problem. Billups gets a call from Captain Freeman, which apparently was just a ruse to give him a chance to get away from his mother. And dun, 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 there's an explosion on the Renfair ship, right? And supposedly the queen was killed. You know, they show her tattered scarf or something. Some piece of her clothing. And we go over to sick bay where Dr. Tana lets Tendi know that there was an accident. And, you know, unfortunately, Rutherford was killed.
Did you guys buy that for at all, like even a second?
I didn't. On. I was like, this feels like a setup, right?
Yeah.
How convenient that they wanted the son there. And
yeah.
And you have her dying and leaving a gaping hole in the hierarchy. So I knew something was up here, right? But the characters don't know yet. We go back down to the planet. We've got Mariner, Boimler, and Lord Agamas. They find a ship that does have an intact engine. There's a disagreement about whether or not they should let Lord Agamas get his danglies into a computer, which results in a fist fight. And eventually Mariner is saying, you don't have the guts to face me. But he did. She gets knocked unconscious by the phaser blast. And Boimler takes the computer over to the sentient computer over to the ship. We are back on the Cerritos where Billups is talking to Captain Freeman, and he is resigning from Starfleet to take his place as king and perform the royal copulation. And they even do like a thing with his hair where, like, you know, his hair changed, but they just kind of waved their hands through it, ran a comb through it almost.
And I love that scene just because as he's resigning, he's got two people next to him. One of them is styling his hair. The other one putting a sash on him, and they're just dressing him up like a king, like on the spot.
Yeah, and they're going to take him away. And as they're taking him away, he says, will it hurt?
Over elsewhere in the Cerritos, I can't remember if this is sick bay or some other hallway or something. Tendi can't believe that Rutherford is dead. And she asks the computer for his location and coincidentally discovers that his cybernetic implant is still on the ship. And she's like, oh, at least there's still a part of him still around, right? And we go retrieve that. We switch over to the planet, and you know, Mariner wakes up from being stunned. Lord Agamas is inside with Boimler on the wrecked ship with the intact engine. He says, hey, you know, I can get things online, you just need to connect me. And Boimler's like, all right, let me try doing it. I can't open the thing that has the little hatch that has the access port. We need some power. And Lord Agamas is like, oh bro, that's fine, just use my battery, right? So he gets connected up, and scary takeover stuff happening as Lord Aaron was like, ha, yes, this is what I wanted. I wanted to be connected to, you know, to the nav console to take over the computer on the ship. Meanwhile, Tendi does locate Rutherford still alive, feasting along with the queen and many others on the ship. And they're cheering to Billups destroying his virginity as they speak. So the plot is laying, you know, laid bare here. And Rutherford, you know, per his training, tries to communicate with the ship to let things know. And the comms are being blocked by a minstrel or bard, if you prefer, strumming away with their Renfair technology. And he's like, all right, I've got to escape and get over there. He's like, he's got to manually tell Billups what's going on here. And the queen's like, this, it's too late, my guards are trained from birth to skip foreplay. There's not enough time. So, you know, Rutherford's trying to leave the ship as the deed is about to start. We see in the quarters, presumably of Billups's quarters, he's there with the two guards. you know, fun action.
Male guard and a female guard, just for those who are driving at home.
That's true. That's true.
It's a nice moment of queer representation in there. They're just leaving the options open for Billups.
Exactly. Exactly. So through this action scene, eventually Rutherford does show up, sees the guards, and asks, "Did his kingdom come?" We find out that no, because Billups was nervous, let's say, in the bathroom.
He hadn't been trained to avoid foreplay.
Yeah. He wasn't warmed up and ready to go, right? We smash cut back over to the planet where Lord Agamus reigns and is going to take over the sector with his drones.
And the murder drones,
yeah. or not. As it turns out, Boimler has been using Lord Agamus's power cell to send a distress signal. So you aren't anywhere near the nav console. You just control the dimmer switch, right? Mariner's impressed by this tricky, like, whoa, you're the sentient megalomaniac, right? And Lord Agamus is like, I shall blind you. And then, yes.
The greatest line, you've been boimed.
Been boimed.
I love that's a verb now. You've been boimed.
And Lord Agamus is not happy and, you know, angrily proclaims that he shall blind you, and then like flicks the switch, the dimmer switch on the lights.
Repeatedly on and off.
Repeatedly on and off. As we're beginning to wrap things up here, you've got Billups, you know, confronting his mother in engineering and proudly proclaiming he'll be a virgin for the rest of his life. Bringing it into that plot line, Tendi wrapping things up with Rutherford, and she's apologizing about pushing him beyond his boundaries. And he says, no, I'm like totally happy. Like, I've had this cool thing and it was fun. And they kind of discuss of like how there, guess there will be times where it seems you have died. And oh, well, that's Starfleet. It's just Tuesday. Yeah, yeah. So it's like this weird, you know, foreshadowing of like, you know, there's definitely at least one way connection between these two, right? It's kind of hard to tell how much beyond friendship Tendi and Rutherford will go, but it certainly seems like Tendi was very concerned about his well-being and seems hesitant about, you know, him being in the line of fire. You know, save that for a later episode, perhaps. We'll come back to this. Meanwhile, we've got Boimler and Mariner saved by a rescue ship, as Lord Agamus, you know, claims he'll be good. He'll be fine. He's already deleted his manipulative subroutines, and maybe he wants you to join Starfleet, and they can put him in the academy, and he could be like the new Seven of Nine, Agamus of One. And instead, he's taken to the Daystrom Institute, where he is put in the self-aware megalomaniac computer storage. He starts ranting and raving, and he's interrupted by all the other self-aware megalomaniac computers in storage that disagree with him. And there's the end.
I really wish that they had preemptively put in an Easter egg in the first season of Picard, where they just walk by and you see that sign on the wall at the Daystrom Institute.
Yeah. They should CGI it into the background, right?
Oh, like, so good.
When he was at the Institute talking to Juardi? Yeah. I can't remember her last name. Juardi? Yeah. You know, just put that, it doesn't even have to be in focus, just like, dude, there's totally like computers back there on a shelf. The shelves.
Yeah.
So kind of unique this episode. This one, it definitely leans into a lot of Star Trek tropes. Mm-hmm. Tons of them, definitely a lot of TOS ones here. And yet also feels a little like this one felt more Rick and Morty-ish than I think a lot of the other episodes do. This one leaned pretty heavily into the more risque side of things.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny. We just had that conversation about the Mugatu Gamato episode and the sort of sauciness of that. This one definitely also walks, tiptoes across that line a few times and tiptoes back. In a very, very humorous way. It's so funny because, you know, they, as Mike McMahon made in that point in that article, you know, Star Trek's not chaste, certainly, especially the original series. I mean, Captain Kirk was sleeping with every woman that he could get near. But it's funny to sort of see how, you know, outside of its comfort zone that can be for Star Trek when you see it hypersexualized, hyper-realized in this way.
Yeah, it's kind of fun how, like, this probably would have felt tonally very different if this was a live action show.
Oh, yeah.
I do think that, that animation gives them some boundaries that they can toe and cross over a few times, and it feels totally fine and tonally okay.
Do you guys think it's interesting that they have continued to keep bringing it back around to Mariner and Boimler and the tension over the Titan now that we're 7 episodes into season 2? Like, are they still, is there something more there, or is this just, it feels like they're really kind of not letting this go, and I wonder if that's deliberate because they're sort of getting somewhere with it?
Feels like it's deliberate, right? Just like they're putting Tendi and Rutherford together in what appears to be foreshadowing of a romantic relationship, mm-hmm. or at least attempt in their case. I'm unclear if it would be a romantic thing or more of a almost like a sibling rivalry and a bit of tension, right? Where like Boimler was kind of the sibling that went, you know, out of state or out of province to school and left their buddy behind. Mm-hmm. So they could mm-hmm. go that route with them. But it does feel like there's something there because it is like they, it seemed like they resolved the, you know, is Boimler going to stay on the Titan thing way earlier in the season than I assumed, having seen the season trailers. Mm-hmm. And yet it's not gone. It's not like they just, you know, wipe their hands clean of it. They're actually seeming to make it be part of kind of both characters. So Boimler is using it as his, like, you know, what did Mariner describe it? Like his study abroad assignment that he did, yes. you know, that he can't yeah. shut up about. And then you have the Mariner side of it where she seems like unreasonably upset and emotional yeah. about yeah. what was clearly a career move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they also played on that other idea that when Agamis says she's more than she seems, and they've been playing that one quite a bit, you know, and then of course, you know, they she's more than she seems. And they just drop a line that sort of says, because you were kind of wondering, are they going to go there? You know, like there's more going on with her, like the, you know, the 2 episodes ago or 3 episodes ago where they had her, this, you know, black ops kind of, you know, person, right?
Yeah. Like how much of that is real or not? Given that they've hinted several times that there's more, and we learn more about the mysterious Mariner background, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's natural that they would sort of have, I mean, it's the Sam and Diane thing again, you know, they put 2 characters together and there's always going to be this dynamic tension, right? Whether, you know, I think we put our bias onto that. I don't think it's necessarily played at. And so they can sort of write in, you know, lines into the story and emotions into the story that make us, you know, buy into that, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're basically colleagues in the same job, right? And there's, you know, the lower decks of the ship, but, you know, in both cases, like in Rutherford and Tendi and Boimler and Mariner, like, you know, is it a pairing or not, right?
Yeah, I gotta be honest, I think this far in, obviously the show, hopefully it runs for quite a while, but I kind of be disappointed. I mean, Tendi and Rutherford maybe, but I kind of think I'd be disappointed if Mariner and Boimler ended up as a couple. They're so much better as sort of that sibling rivalry kind of dynamic. Well,
you know, that's what ruined Cheers, to be honest with you. If you, I remember watching Cheers in the early days, and there was always that sort of tension, and then when Sam and Diane finally did hook up, it just, like, it ruined it, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I didn't find that one as egregious as the, it was Moonlighting was the one, right? Back in the 80s.
Yeah,
that was the one that absolutely got destroyed by when they finally got together. You were like, but that was what the whole show was the will they, won't they? And when they did, you were like, and now who cares? But yeah, I mean, I feel like these 2 characters are way more fun as sort of big sister, little brother rivals, you know, I'm gaining experience, I've got experience, you're on your way somewhere, I'm jealous that you've actually got a purpose, kind of, it's way more fun than will they, won't they fall in love, right?
Yeah, and I wonder if this will be less like Moonlighting, which was Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd, I think.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe more like Frasier with Roz, right? They do hook up mm-hmm. kind of late in the series, and they're like, oh, this is a mistake, right? We shouldn't have let that happen.
Yep.
And yeah, it didn't fundamentally change the show because the show wasn't about that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I've always hated that as the moral on television. It feels like it's something that you get to when you realize you don't have anything else to do with your characters. But I hate the notion that every show eventually says that men and women can't just be friends. That right. seems to be mm-hmm. the punchline mm-hmm. to so many of these circumstances that, like, you know, I've had, like, lifelong female friends, you know, we're never going to sleep together. That's not what this is about. We're just about being friends. And so many of these shows, you know, for years and years and years, they have their own dynamics, but eventually they're going to hook up. And you're like, but that's not how life works, right?
Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed.
Interesting.
Shall we move on to what if?
What if Thor was an only child?
What if Thor was an only child?
And why is Loki so giant?
Well, because he's a frost giant.
Indeed. So,
but is he a frost giant in real life?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to go back to the first Thor movie where they cover how Odin somehow ended up with a frost giant child. I don't know if he absconded with one or discovered one.
He basically took him as a hostage, more or less, so that Laufey, the king of the frost giants, wouldn't, you know, continue to wage
attack
war.
The palace or whatever.
Yeah.
Like Theon Greyjoy was taken as semi-hostage by the Starks.
Yep.
So why is he Theon size? Why isn't he, like, in this version, he's much taller?
Tim, you're asking the wrong question, because he is, by heritage, a frost giant. What you should be asking is, when we normally see Loki, why is he so tiny?
That's and what micro-sized. I'm asking. Why is he so small?
I think the idea is that he is supposed to have been enchanted by Odin to basically be
and not be blue,
an Asgardian by all identity. But we actually do see his skin turn blue in the original Thor movie, and he starts to understand what his real heritage is and everything.
Oh, okay, right.
But yeah,
so for those of you who are confused by where we're going with this, the plot line is that what if they didn't adopt Loki and Thor ends up growing up as a single child with all this, you know, money and splendor and whatever, and he ends up being a typical, as they play it out, you know, rich boy jerk, right?
He's the party god.
He's the party god, yeah.
Yeah, this was it's funny, we've been talking about how the first two episodes were sort of more light in spirit, and the last four episodes had all been pretty grim, and this one regains that very light spirit again. It's, you know, Thor basically shows up on Earth while his father is asleep and his mother is on a well-earned vacation. He basically takes all of his drinking buddies, the Warriors Three, Lady Sif, and, you know, all the ne'er-do-wells that they've encountered across the galaxy, and brings them to Earth for, like, an epic party.
To Midgard, yeah.
To Midgard, yeah. And, you know, and so from there we get, like, cameos galore. We get Howard the Duck again. We get Jeff Goldblum as the Grandmaster. Mm-hmm. Nebula, Drax, Mantis, Yondu, Skrulls. You know, everybody comes down for this huge bender on Earth. And against that are Jane Foster, which was actually Natalie Portman,
and Kat Dennings,
Kat Dennings as Darcy, and
Chris Hemsworth.
And Chris Hemsworth, yeah, no, it's a good voice cast in this one, all in. And of course Hiddleston was back, and Sam Jackson. And anyway, so the two of them are basically trying to figure out, you know, Jane is just like in the original Thor movie, she's smitten and falling in love with this charming and good looking Hemsworth-esque animated character, and, you know, meanwhile she's also trying to figure out, oh, is he actually a danger, what's gonna happen, and so sure enough it starts to turn from, you know, an epic party in Las Vegas into a party pandemic, right? It's spreading across the earth, and parties are breaking out everywhere. They're, you know, doing tricks on the top of the Sydney Opera House. They've ripped up the St. Louis Arch to use as a giant slingshot. Nick Fury ends up getting wiped out by Korg at one point by accident. Yep. And
well, Colby Smothers was also doing the voice of,
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. What's her name?
She's Maria Hill.
Maria Hill. Yeah. And she's acting chief of Shields or whatever.
Right? That's right. That's right. Yeah. And we even get a very funny, Surtur trying to pick up Lady Liberty in Manhattan Harbor there.
Yeah, and melting her.
And melting her arm off, yeah. So in order to try and find a way to stop this, Maria Hill decides to call in the big guns and presses the giant, the button on the pager from Captain Marvel, and Captain Marvel returns to Earth, and we end up with Captain Marvel versus Thor going, you know, 3 or 4 rounds around the Earth. He's just sort of saying, you know, oh, you're a party pooper and you're ruining my party. And in the end, the punchline is that they have to, they threaten basically to call his mom. And so they call in his mom, and as she's on her way to Midgard to catch him in the act, he and the rest of the gang have to tidy up like kids after a house party. And it's pretty funny episode, pretty sort of fun and lighthearted. And again, even through a cartoon, Hemsworth is extremely charming and funny. Goldblum gets in some great lines as a joke. Darcy and Howard the Duck getting married in Vegas was pretty funny. But the last scene continues the trend that we've seen over the last episodes. And we've been talking about trying to find the thread, and it seems like the thread is that no matter how these things play out, there's sort of this punchline of, and then it all goes wrong. And in this case, the last thing we see is what looks to be a Vision Ultron wielding the Infinity Gems invading the Earth. And yeah, okay, so we've got 2 episodes left of this season. Mm-hmm. Clearly there's a crossover of some fashion coming, whether it's, you know, the last 2 parts or the last single part. I am very curious to see how they're going to bring this together now. I mean, there is a thread. We're now starting to see it. I wonder where this goes. You guys have any thoughts? Mm.
Well, these are all multiverse stories,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, they're not going to... They may cross over, but, I mean, the whole idea of multiverse is multiple plot lines, right?
It's true, but it seems like maybe there's a thread weaving through these.
There's sort of the aspect of fate, that something is, like, there's a certain timeline that's going to... Like was it the Loki show, or... Loki's show had this sort of... There's this immutable time... You know, time elements that can't be changed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that's part of it, right?
Like, it was the Doctor Strange one, right? It was the fact that his girlfriend dies, and that can't be changed, because if it's changed, he can't be Doctor Strange. If he can't be Doctor Strange, he can't stop the Dormammu.
If you remember in the Loki, like the second to last episode, they show him the timeline, and there's like, no matter what they do, there's always this sort of like part where things just fall apart.
Yep.
You know? No matter how they try to control it, right? So
yeah, interesting. Again, I like this episode. That was fun, and it was nice after a series of heavies to have one that wasn't all that. Although, again, the ending does leave a lot of interesting time for speculation over the next week. But I really enjoyed this episode. I laughed again. I think all the cameos were a lot of fun. I thought this was great.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, it's interesting when you watch the beginning of the show. And you see the comic book pages flipping, and then you start to see, you know, Jeffrey Hunter talking, and you see the names of the people who are going to be in the show, and you're like, oh, you immediately know that these characters, even like you see Taika Waititi, and you know he's going to be in the show, right? You know, and you see Natalie Portman and Kat Jennings, and you know that they're going to play what role they're going to play. There's no surprise there, right?
Yeah.
You know, and whereas... I almost kind of want to not know who's going to show up and just have them show up, you know?
Yeah, and I think that was kind of the fun of this episode, was because it was the big party. It was just who's going to show up next and what's going to happen, how crazy is it going to get?
There's a couple of books that... So Heinlein wrote a book. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. I can't remember what it is, but... But it starts out where these people are, you know, they have these cars they can jump in, and they fly from planet to planet and that kind of stuff. And they end up, they discover this tool, kind of like the flux capacitor, where they can rotate it and change into different multiverses, right? And so that's the first thing they do, is they go to a multiverse, and they end up on Mars or the moon or something, and it's occupied, the British have occupied it. And they don't have airplanes, they have ornithopters, right? Mm. All this kind of stuff. And as the story goes, at one point they end up in this one, universe where all of Heinlein's characters are alive and they all know each other and they're all at this big party. Right. You know, so as you, if you read, you know, if you had read all of, you know, the books up to that point, you would have seen the, you know, you would recognize all the characters that were at this sort of big feast, kind of like this episode. Right. Kind of an interesting twist on the, and the idea. And the idea is that all these characters who are, were written by Heinlein know that they were written by Heinlein.
That's funny. Right?
So it's kind of fun, fun little twist there. Yeah. Multiverse stuff is, can be fun.
Yep.
Oh, show. It might have been called Number of the Beast, now that I think about it. Yeah. Anywho, all right. And the other thing we talked, I think we all dipped into at least episode one of Star Wars Visions, which came out. The interesting that they dropped all the episodes at once. I think one of our fans of the show mentioned that on our Slack channel. That, yeah, it's kind of, and I think you guys were sort of thinking, oh, I have to stay and watch all of it, right?
Yeah, I looked at it, as this was going to be a sort of a bridge thing, because I was trying to figure out what sort of the next thing is. And I know we're not getting Hawkeye for a little while. It's not coming out till November. I was trying to figure out, you know, sort of what the next Disney Plus thing is in the short term. And I assumed going into this that that was going to fill that, that void. It is interesting because they had been doing so many of those, the Disney Plus Marvel shows, the Disney Plus Star Wars shows have been week to week episodic. This is obviously a different format. They're different lengths, the different episodes. Some of them are as brief as, you know, 10, 12 minutes. And I think there's a couple of them that are closer to 20. So, and all in, I think there's what, 8 episodes and a grand total of like 2 hours and change. So yeah, it's interesting that they've chosen to do it this way.
But is this because, is this animatism? Because other shows, like the Robots one, the Dreaming Robot one that I watch on Netflix.
Well, Love and Robots?
Is it Love and Robots? Yeah. The Love, Death and Robots or something like that, right? But the idea that this kind of, these kind of short stories can't be, like people wouldn't stand for it if we only presented one per week or two per week or whatever. Like the longer hour-long formats, they seem, and like what I mean is, would it be engaging enough for people to come back and watch, you know, as they drop each episode? Like, or do they think that they need to drop them all at once, as they've done here, right? And again, it's also because of the length too, right? They're short, you know, dim sum sized, you know, bits, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I guess it suits the, you know, whatever suits the story, right? The length, the, you know, the animation style seemed to vary episode to episode. So to clarify for our listeners, Tim, you've watched one, I've watched two, and Jaime's watched three. And, you know, even just the two that I've watched, the animation style shifts pretty dramatically. I'm sure Jaime will confirm that it probably shifts again for the third episode. I don't know. I mean, you probably could have done it. I mean, you think that the obvious comparison is the Animatrix, right? Animatrix.
Yeah.
A variety.
Well, also
of
heavy metal. I was thinking about heavy metal too, or not the heavy metal movie, but the heavy metal magazine, which were always, and I guess a lot of comic book too, right? Like different artists would take, just write a story and throw it into this magazine and they would publish it monthly, and it would be, you know, sometimes the stories would be similar or derivative, you know, but generally speaking, like, you know, you got a Mobius story and you got, you know, so-and-so story. And the same thing with Mad Magazine, you would get little short, you know, vignettes that would happen. And that's kind of where Love, Death and Robots and Animatrix and this show is. It's sort of taking, you know, George Lucas's worlds and playing with them, right?
Yeah, but I'm glad they're doing different styles. Like, I had read a little bit of Star Wars manga over the years, and that was more in line with the second episode, which was a little more sort of aimed at a younger audience, a little more cartoony style, a little less of that sort of more mature take on anime. And I can't say that I loved it. It always just felt a little puerile. Whereas the first episode, I don't know what your impressions are, guys, but I thought the first episode was really, like, it was quite beautiful and interesting, the art style, the way they chose to portray it, the starkness, really, the colors really only been highlighting in
the hand-drawn pen and ink kind of style.
And then using the color really only black in the and lightsabers and stuff. I thought that was really quite an interesting art choice.
Well, and also spoilers for people who haven't watched it. The one character that, you know, they think is a Jedi isn't a Jedi. Or maybe he's trained in that way, or he's got, you know, he's got a lot of midichlorians in his bloodstream or something, because that explains everything, right? But he pulls out a Sith lightsaber, right? And, you know, and then it looks like he's been collecting the gems that make the Sith lightsabers work.
Yeah,
right?
The kyber crystals, yeah.
Yeah, so he, you know, obviously everybody in the story thinks he's a Jedi until he pulls out his sword and they're like, what are you, right? Mm. So interesting sort of twist there, you know. I mean, I have my theories, but, you know.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if this is something that they do again, if this is sort of a one-off sort of little animation experiment, or if this is something that mm-hmm. they do as an anthology in different ways.
That's the style I was talking about, anthology, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're our biggest anime buff. What was your take on what you saw so far?
The first one was interesting because it isn't like a lot of other anime. It does feel more like a Kurosawa film. It feels like Seven Samurai style. Yeah. The second episode is, I can't place which anime it would be, but it's definitely a more modern kind of kids-friendly one. So, you know, it's okay. I can see what they're going for there. The twins I liked, and this is the one I had noted from the trailer, seemed like a Kill la Kill reference, very sort of extreme and over the top in people yelling at each other and doing wild action stuff. So I think you all will enjoy that one in a very different way from the Duel. The Duel is very, very moody, very serious, dramatic. The Twins is a little bit more lighthearted and kind of poppy modern anime. So it's fun seeing all these different styles. So I'll be very curious to see what the rest of the what remaining six episodes are like.
Yeah. I would say as a concept, though, I am enjoying what I've seen so far just to explore something different, some uncovered ground. Okay, so here I teased you guys in our pre-show, I teased you guys with a question. So here's the one I'm going to throw to you. So when Disney purchased Lucasfilm, they took everything that had previously existed outside of the movies and Clone Wars and said everything else, comic books, books, games, everything, none of that was canon anymore. And then they have been cherry picking things that they want. But what they said was anything we produce from now on, whether it's a video game, it's a TV show, it's a comic book, it's a novel, is considered canon. Where does this fit in canon?
Yeah, that'd be really rough to try to fit together in canon, given the three different episodes that I saw.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see a statement from Lucasfilm, please, because that is incongruous.
So let's look at it this way. So are you looking at the plots themselves don't fit into canon? Like, forget about the animation.
I don't think it has anything to do with the animation because they've already established the things that are animated are canon. We've seen that with Clone Wars. We've seen that with Rebels. We've seen that with Resistance.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, so... Because how I interpret what we're seeing in an anthology series like this is that here's a story about a Sith versus some sort of Jedi guy. Let's just say that, right? And this is how the people in that realm would tell that story.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to spin it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it's kind of like, is it the Luke and Leia versus Darth Vader story? Not literally, but is it that kind of, imagine that story being told like the little kids in the movie you guys hate, the second Star Wars one, I think, where they go to the kids sweeping the floors, the little slave kids.
Oh yeah. And, well, Last Jedi, that was actually the better of the most recent three, but still.
But what I'm saying though is like in that scene where the one kid is retelling the story to the other kids, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. He's basically telling A New Hope to, you know, with little straw dolls or whatever. He's just, you know, it's kind of like that's, you know, this is the language of this region and this is how they portray the story, or this is how the story is told. In the same sense that, you know, like Japanese art is different than, you know, Chinese art that's different than North American art that's different to Parisian art, right? There are, you know, in the history of art, there have been convergences in styles, but only sometimes through, you know, people traveling in and out of regions, but, you know, like you have Russian abstract art evolved differently than Paris abstract art, but at some point they all become the same because they're abstract, right? Mm. If you saw an exhibition of abstract art from the, you know, 10s and 20s and 30s of the 19th, 20th century, then you would see, like, to the uneducated person, it's all abstract. But, you know, to someone who's learned, they would know which region and even which artist produced that art and what influenced them, right? So even though they're all telling the same story.
Yeah, I think one of the things you hit on is really interesting, too. I think the one way to view this, if you were trying to canonize this, would be to say that these stories also could be set over a huge swath of time, right? The first episode could be set, you know, 1,000 years in the past. The second episode, not to spoil anything for you, Tim, but it has some contemporary Star Wars characters in it. Sure, so yeah. It's set within a time frame that we would at least be able to recognize. But yeah, that's a way to look at it too, is that, you know, just because we're seeing the Star Wars universe doesn't mean it's set in the now, right? It's not, you know, and then you see Rey and Finn walk by, right? It could be set any time.
Right, yeah. Oh, you just ruined it for me.
I will say, and then again, this is not a huge spoiler, but I was impressed to see, and I haven't seen the third one, Jaime, so maybe you can comment on this, but the second episode actually has some pretty big name voice actors in it. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is one of the voices. Chimora Morrison, the guy who plays Boba Fett and Jango Fett, is one of the voices. Bobby Moynihan from Saturday Night Live was one of the voices. I honestly didn't expect that at all. That there would be, you know, high profile. I mean, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's a very prominent actor. I was interested to see that they had actually gone that route.
Yeah, I didn't catch any of those. Well, okay, Tamara Morrison I did, but all the other Joseph Gordon-Levitt, etc., I didn't catch them. So I did watch the third one. If there were people with prominent voices, I didn't catch it.
Well, now we'll have to check back in next week and see what else we spot.
Mm-hmm. Or we could just watch the credits. Cool. Yeah. All right, let's get to our watch list then. Then what do you guys got in the watch list?
Yeah.
Fear this story. Okay, go ahead. Tell me.
I, for the first time, sat down and watched the trailers for the Foundation series based on the Asimov books that's coming to Apple TV Plus this week. And I must admit, I'm kind of intrigued. I know that this is just a setup for failure. I know that this is a fool's errand, that this is one of the most challenging things to adapt. I know that this is sacrosanct for a lot of Asimov and longtime sci-fi fans, particularly those over the age of 60, no offense. It's a very important piece of sci-fi in the grand scheme of sci-fi. But I'll admit that, you know, some of what I saw, I certainly found intriguing. The visuals look top notch. The performances, there's a lot of actors that I recognize. Jared Harris seems to be one of the stars from Mad Men. I got to admit, I'm inclined to check it out. I really am. And you, Tim, will you be checking it out?
Oh, I'll be watching it.
Yeah?
I'll be watching it. Yeah. I'll have my microscope out and I'll be watching it. And I'm, you know, again... Yeah, I should have just checking something on IMDb. Let's see here.
Is it the voice cast for Star Wars Visions? Because I've got that up in front of me now.
Yeah, no, I already did that. I already went there, and I'm looking at something else.
Well, you, I'll vamp for you here. So I'm just looking at different voices. So Simu Liu, Allison Brie, David Harbour, Lucy Liu, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Karen Fukuhara, who's from The Boys, Henry Golding, Bobby Moynihan, we talked about Kimiko Glenn, James Hong, the legendary James Hong, Jamie Chung, Kyle Chandler. This is a pretty good cast. Now I'm even.
I was
going
to say that Jared Harris plays Harry Seldon, who's the main character in the first book and all the books. I mean, he's the guy who writes prehistory. If you don't know what that is, then go back and read the books. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully this is just they're talking about the first book, which is called Foundation, right? Because there's a lot of things they could, ruin, or there's a lot of things they could tell in all of the stuff that Asimov wrote, right? So They could milk that for you. They could. I mean, he did. I mean, he started writing in the 50s and ended up writing. I think he ended in the 2000s. He was still writing stuff, right?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how far they go down this road. If this is sort of has a beginning, middle, end. If they think this is going to be a foundational piece for Disney Plus. I keep wanting to call it Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus. If this is something that they see as, you know, for lack of a better term, a foundational piece where they can have, you know, years and years of this that people will come back and want it in the same way that I think that's what Amazon's trying to build its Lord of the Rings stuff. Each one of these sort of, you know, tentpole television franchises that the streaming services are trying to build. Mm-hmm. It certainly seems to have that potential. I mean, it looks very grand in scope. It has a you know, top-notch cast. It seems like they didn't spare any money on the production.
So can we talk about iRobot then?
We can.
So this character of Susan Calvin is, like, iRobot is originally a series of short stories that Asimov wrote over time, right? And he published, you know, in various magazines, and they got compiled into a compendium called iRobot. And they were all, you know, they were written in different magazines and stuff like that. And Susan Calvin and the three laws of robotics were something that he developed, you know, over time, and then they became overarching things. And so she, like, the, you know, she's the character, the female character in the movie with I can't remember his name now. Will
Smith?
Will, yeah, Smith. thank you. But I mean, you know, and that story, I mean, it was told like one of the short stories that Asimov would have written, but, you know, kind of way over the top with the Hollywood budget and stuff like that, right? But it was told like one of the stories that is in the whole sort of iRobot canon stuff that Asimov wrote. And it was so far removed from the Asimov style of storytelling that, you know, it became very Hollywood, you know, and that's what worries me about this kind of storytelling. And the same thing with Brave New World that they just did recently. It missed all the sort of main, you know, gravitas that the Brave New World story book has, you know. They sat there with a checklist and they went through all the plot points in the stories, but it just didn't translate well to, you know, a TV show that what was really going on in the book, you know, kind of thing, right? So that's what worries me about what they're going to do with Foundation. I think that, you know, it'll look spectacular, right? And the cast will be wonderful, and they will hit the plot points, but will they really have the same sort of, like, you know, style? I'm worried about, you know, the character. You guys have read the books, right?
Not all of them. I read iRobot, no. And I think I've read Foundation.
Oh, you haven't read the Foundation series? Okay. I mean, you know, it's kind of like watching Harry Potter, never having read any of the books, but, like one of my favorite characters in, there's a couple of favorite characters that I have in Asimov's world, but one of them is a character called the Mule, who shows up in the second Foundation book. And the way, you know, the way he's introduced and the way the characters evolve in that story are really interesting. And it's probably a style that's been done, but, you know, when I first read it, written by Asimov, and I think he wrote it in the 50s or 60s, you know, it was quite interesting, the way it worked, right? And they could mess that up really easily, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to give spoilers away, and we'll see if they even, hopefully in the first 10 episodes, they're not going to get there. I assume that they're doing multiple seasons, right? Yeah, it says here season one, 10 episodes. So, yeah, interesting to see. But, yeah. And then, you know, like Heinlein's stories have been turned into movies, too. And some of them are pretty good and some of them are pretty bad, you know? Like Puppet Masters was a great story. But, it was a movie. I think it was a movie with Donald Sutherland, if I'm not mistaken. But, the movie was okay, you know? It wasn't as great as the story. So I don't know. I guess that's the thing. That's the difference between most novelizations or novels that get turned into movies. They don't quite, you know, it's hard. I guess it's hard to take that whole world and put it into, you know, an hour or two. What do you got for us, Jaime?
I think a little bit more lighthearted. Somebody has taken all 7 seasons intro credits for Star Trek The Next Generation and synced them up into one video. And it's surprising how different they are in lengths. Like, you just watch, it is less than 2 minutes And they start off a little behind, especially season one. Season one is like the weirdest one. Season two matches up with it a little bit. They sort of tinker with when exactly do certain things occur. And then sort of shocking to me is that season one is the longest of all of the intros. If you'd asked me, do they differ at all? I would have told you no. And I've seen this like a million times. It was kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm watching it now with the sound up. But yeah, it is totally, totally different. But it's kind of like we notice a difference in the Lower Decks. You know, the last season, this season is completely different, right? The same story gets told in the sequences, but the, you know, they went back and they got more CGI budget for them or whatever.
Yeah.
Animated CGI budget, that is.
Yeah, and then the way that the Star Trek The Next Generation logo comes in, the sort of weird outlier is season five that has the, like the kind of more TOS style streamers.
I wonder if that lines up with when the movie was out. Like, because they were doing the original series cast movies at the same time, right?
I was kind of wondering whether we'd probably have to look at the timing, but it did have that sort of feel to it. That mm-hmm. seasons, you know, all other seasons except five have the same, you know, font and everything. Not plain, but plainer than the much more gussied up version for season five. I wonder why they changed that. I wonder why they changed away from it.
It's a mystery that will never be known.
Well, I'm sure it's written in a book somewhere. Cool. I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where will they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwiththehair.
All right. And Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
All right. As usual, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra. On the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. Until next time, we'll see you in the future.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Spockcast Podcast. This is Jean-Luc Picard. Shut up, Wesley. Sorry, say again. Just the tag. Gotcha. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spockcast website at spockcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spockcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpockcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spockcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spockcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
This super sexy version of Spockcast, your sexy goodbyes.
It just, you know how it flips over to another movie after you watch the first one?
Mm-hmm. It random, gives you a recommendation and kind of goes to autoplay.
YouTube-y thing, yeah, yeah. All the Star Wars television show intros. So, which is now, we've just proven that it's wrong because there were like seven seasons and seven different ones, right? Have they done the same thing with Voyager and Deep Space Nine and...
Yeah, so I do know that the TNG ones change a bit because you have Denise Crosby leaving. You have Kate McFadden being there, leaving, coming back. You know, other cast changes. Voyager would presumably have Jennifer Neely. I forget Kes's real name. Well, they'd have Kes's actress leave, and then you'd have Jerry Ryan come in as Seven of Nine.
There was a crossover, though, because I just watched the episode where they used the Borg technology to fight off some people, and Seven is still a Borg. Have you guys seen that episode?
Which one is it? Because there was and I looked it up, Jennifer Leon for Kes.
So Kes is sitting in the chair, and she's got long hair, so it's near the end of her tenure on the show, right? And Seven is helping them. And then, you know, at the end of it, she says, you'll be assimilated and whatever. Resistance.
Is it part of the Scorpion ones with when they fight the Borg and Species 8472.
Yeah, I don't know who they're fighting, but they use Borg technology to... She opens up a singularity or something like that, and they fly through it.
With the transwarp conduits?
Yeah, yeah. And then Chakotay's reminding her that she was a young girl named Monica and all that kind of stuff, right? But she's still got all the implants in her face and, you know, yep. Anywho, whatever. 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 All right. Is that it?
I think so.
Think so.
All right. Talk to you guys later.
Talk to you later.
All right. Okay, have a good week, guys.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.